Welcome to Between the Bubbles, your place for independent and critical takes on topics at the nexus of science, society, politics, and economics. I'm your host, Ninad Bondre. Thanks for joining me. In this first season of the podcast, I want to take you back to 2016, when just under half of the American public voted to put Donald Trump into power as the president, and just over half of the British public voted to exit the EU. And what happened then was the rapid emergence of this intriguing notion or narrative of post-truth, so much so that Oxford Dictionary declared it as the word of the year. This notion then rapidly became a dystopian frame for understanding what many considered to be a crisis of liberal democracy. Now, the story could well have emerged in the 1990s, or even at least in 2004, when Ralph Keyes penned a book entitled The Post-Truth Era. But the circumstances then weren't quite right, and instead it took the tumultuous events of 2016 for this narrative to really take hold. In this first episode of the podcast, then, I want to briefly look at what various intellectuals have said about the notion. Then, I will offer my own critical take, which is based primarily on an article in the Philosophical Salon that I wrote at the end of 2020. So let's have a closer look at what the mainstream means by post-truth. And for that, we might as well rely on the definition provided by Oxford Dictionary, which is a state of affairs in which objective facts are less influential than appeals to emotion or belief in shaping public opinion. So the claim being made here is that facts and information, which previously played an important role in policy and decision making, have now been replaced by aspects such as values and emotions. So objective facts do not any longer have this exalted position. They have been cheapened, in a sense. Many have followed this definition with their own variants, and some others have introduced some other tweaks there. So, for example, the journalist James Ball has likened this notion to bullshit, and Yael Brahms, in a comprehensive review of the notion, has talked about the inability to clarify reality in order to understand it and function within it on the basis of facts. Now, there are also many related terms here, like fake news, misinformation, disinformation, alternative facts, which you're all aware of. I consider all of these terms to be part of the same constellation, of which post-truth can then serve as a nice overarching philosophical term that brings these various terms together. So by the end of 2016 or so, post-truth and these related terms became extremely popular, and academics, journalists, and others began bemoaning our entry into an allegedly post-truth era. I was really uncomfortable when I first came across this notion. I just felt that things didn't add up somehow, and this feeling of mine has only been reinforced over the years. My primary issue, initially at least, was the assumption of a truth era that preceded the so-called post-truth era. And this seemed to me like an assumption that at best could be called a hypothesis that should have been tested empirically. Instead, I felt that academics and journalists really treated it as a done deal, and then they worked backwards to explain how we got here. It's very difficult to buy this notion of some sort of a truth era preceding the current post-truth era. Just think about the lead-up to the Iraq War, for example. Could one ever say that that period was part of some idyllic truth era? I think people were aware, at least subconsciously, of the difficulties posed by these sorts of historical events. Nevertheless, it seemed like they had made up their minds that we were now in a post-truth era. So how do you rationalize these two? Well, maybe that is why they began to complexify post-truth, if you will. So they said, it's not about simple lying. It's something far more sinister. People are losing even the capacity to distinguish between what's true and what's false. But just think about that. Were we in such dire straits, then why would survey after survey point to scientists and doctors enjoying great public trust? Even the most recent survey that I've come across, which looked at several European countries and just came out now in June, points clearly to the fact that the public has great trust in scientists. Indeed, most things we take for granted in our modern existence are in some ways related to experts armed with facts and information. Take the example of driving through a tunnel or flying in a plane. Do we refuse to do these things because we don't trust expertise or we are somehow unable to distinguish between what's true and what's false? And there are many, many other examples like this that you could think of. So whence this alleged inability to function on the basis of facts? Of course, many of us are skeptical or less receptive to certain facts. All of us come with some confirmation biases. We filter information in terms of our cultural or political preferences. Some of us simply are conspiracy theorists, irrespective of the topic. And yes, there is a vocal minority of skeptics when it comes to topics such as climate change or even COVID-19 more recently. But what this community typically does is not to question the primacy of facts as such. They simply want to replace one set of facts by others which they believe better reflect the scientific state of affairs. Maybe this is why Lee McIntyre has argued that the post-truth era is about some facts being favored over others, based on political or subjective considerations. But arguably, this is not a new phenomenon. Surely it didn't start in 2016, or even in the 1970s for that matter. Alright, so these were some of the issues that I had with the mainstream post-truth narrative when it first emerged. Early on, I thought that others with more formal expertise than I, because I'm definitely not a social science or humanities expert by any means, so I thought that others with more expertise would poke holes into this narrative, would point out to the inconsistencies and the lack of empirical evidence for this narrative. But to my growing frustration, not only did this not happen, but intellectuals seemed rather keen to board the bandwagon en masse. The notion emerged in 2016, but already by 2017, many had penned dystopian, apparently definitive accounts, not only essays, but even books. Yes, there were some early critical voices, for example, Sheila Jasanoff and her colleague, who cautioned against the premature ringing of funeral bells of truth. And maybe some other communities were also discussing internally, perhaps at conferences and so on. But in the space that really mattered, the public space, primarily journalism, dissenting voices were conspicuous by their absence. This might sound harsh, but the discussion was dominated by voices that were happy to accept the new era as a given, busying themselves with uncovering its origins and recommending remedies. Ironically, the very people bemoaning the onset of the post-truth era were, or at least seemed to be, the ones least interested in subjecting their assumptions to critical scrutiny. In my reading, published critiques began to arrive in earnest around 2018 onwards. I won't go into the details of the various critiques because I've devoted separate episodes of the podcast for them, but I would like to give a brief overview here. And suffice it to say that the critiques come from many different directions, which I think is their strength. Perhaps the most comprehensive of the critiques comes from Johan Farkas and Yannick Skau, who wrote a book entitled Post-Truth, Fake News and Democracy. And in this book, they challenge the assumption or the premise that the health of democracy depends on truth. I think it's worth reading a small quote from that book. They say, "We argue that not only have contemporary concerns around democracy and truth been severely limited in their understanding of what democracy is, they have also taken for granted that democratic practices are almost solely about truth, rationality, and consensus. This need not be the case. Indeed, it should not be the case." End quote. I was also really impressed by some very searching questions that Kathryn Brown asked in a couple of articles that she published in a journal called Critical Policy Studies. And I think there are excerpts there that are worth reading out here too. At one point she says, "Polemically speaking, we see the latest version of good versus evil, and one where liberals, academics, scientists, the enlightened, the progressives, and the educated find themselves conveniently placed on the side of the good, with no further need to question their own, respectively, our own biases and blind spots, our knowledges and our truths." End quote. And finally, Catherine Happer, in her examination of the relationship between trust in media and post-truth, has pointed out that it's of course crucial that journalists call out the distortions and inaccuracies of those in power. But what Trump's team and the Brexiteers seem to understand better is that currently the problem lies not so much in the production of facts, alternative or otherwise, but in the reception. It's the winning back of trust in journalism that must be addressed. So I just want to end this episode by asking the question of what explains the meteoric rise of the post-truth narrative, its conversion into a bandwagon that journalists, academics, and even politicians of a certain bent were scrambling to board. Well, there's not really one answer here, but many possible ones. The first and obvious one is the shock of Brexit and the election of Trump. These were events that were really unthinkable, especially for the liberals amongst us. And in their mad rush to find explanations, alternative frames of analysis, such as the crisis of neoliberalism, capitalism, or indeed liberalism itself, were set aside for positing a crisis of truth, in which certain gullible others could be held as culpable. Another reason could be that the happenings of 2016 provided fuel or an excuse to lambast constructivist or interpretive traditions of knowledge, the evils of postmodernism, as some would say. It seems to me that some are always lying in wait for this sort of an opportunity. And as Farkas and Skow have pointed out in their book, a caricature of postmodernism has served as a convenient strawman in the post-truth discourse. Then, the critical disciplines such as science and technology studies may have been unwilling or simply unable to keep up with the pace of debate in a digital world. And finally, the cost of challenging this narrative in the loaded political atmosphere of the Trump years might have been seen as being simply too much to bear. On the flip side, the benefits of conformity, virtue signaling among one's academic or cultural peers, were simply too high to miss out on. I do hope that future analysis will take a closer look at some of these possible reasons, investigate them in greater detail, and come up with a more comprehensive explanation for this interesting phenomenon. So how has this story evolved and where does it go from this point onwards? In my article in late 2020, I had wondered about how the post-truth narrative would evolve post-Trump. The dynamics that led to Brexit or propelled Trump to power have not changed substantially. And other dynamics, for example, those related to the COVID-19 pandemic, have developed in the meanwhile. It's true that the notion of post-truth has somewhat receded in the background, as terms such as misinformation or disinformation have come into prominence. But it's unlikely that this story is over. My own take home from what has happened until now, and admittedly from my critical perspective, is that the origin of this post-truth narrative and its quick conversion into a bandwagon serves as a reminder. A reminder that nuanced and context-specific analysis of contemporary issues should not be sacrificed for the security of simplicity. And on that note, thanks for joining this first episode of Between the Bubbles. If you liked what you heard, do alert your friends and colleagues and ask them to share the podcast with others who might be interested. And do join me for the forthcoming episodes of the podcast, which look at many different facets of the post-truth narrative. And have a look at the website for information about some of the topics that we discussed today, especially links to the relevant articles. Thanks again, and see you next time.